The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start. Three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and it's nice to be here on this rainy afternoon in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you all for joining us. We have a great show with one of our favorite guests, so let me get down to business so that we can get into our discussion. So for those of you who would like to call today and talk to Dr. Ben Arroyo, who I will introduce in just a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient and let the phone ring, and I'll answer it and get you up on air as quickly as possible. And you can also send us email at drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is also our website, thespaceshow.com, so do check it out. We already have the website newsletter uploaded and posted for this coming week, so our upcoming shows, except that do note there will be no show next Sunday due to Easter Sunday. So the last show of the week will be on Friday. And the new newsletter will go out early tomorrow morning about 6 a.m. California time. If you would like to subscribe to the email newsletter, send me your email address to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything is archived. You can easily download these programs right off of the website or listen to them. Either way that works for you. And remember that the blog is integrated to the archives of our show. So as soon as a program is in the upcoming show section over on the right sidebar menu, you can start commenting on the show. So for those of you who want to comment on today's show as the show is ongoing, feel free to do so. I'll get copies of those posts, and I can read them on the air as if you were sending an email comment or question for Dr. Ben Arroyo. Please note that we still have our Space Show store, and you can find it in the upper menu in the upper left side of the website. And check it out. We have some interesting items that you may find interesting. I hope you do. Your feedback also is also welcome. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do and will be supporting us financially. We thank you for that support. Without it, there would be no Space Show program. And remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, because we are a nonprofit 501c3 with onegiantleapfoundation.org, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer, as we are a California public benefit corporation. And then we do have sponsors, so especially since our new website took off. And I'm happy to tell you that the first half of our show today has two sponsors. So one of them is Celestis, which is the premier space memorial and burial service. And their message for today is the following. Celestis Earthrise Memorial Spaceflight Mission are flown aboard an Up Aerospace Spaceloft XL rocket launched from the Spaceport America, New Mexico site. Founded by Jerry Larson in 2003, Up Aerospace has already conducted more than a dozen missions to space with return to Spaceport America for customers including NASA, DOD, and commercial aerospace companies. Last year, Up Aerospace was awarded a $10 million contract from NASA's Flight Opportunities Program to conduct increasingly more complex missions. recently up began development of an orbital launch vehicle that will launch in 2017. Celestis plans to be on board with the new vehicle. It's named Spider, and it should begin operations maybe next year or the year after. To view the most recent Celestis Earthrise missions and tribute flights conducted in November 2015, visit the Celestis YouTube channel at youtube.com/CelestisMFF. MSF to see the other information about Celestis, visit their website, celestis.org. AIAA is also a sponsor, and AIAA has five annual forums, which are really like conferences: SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion, and Energy, as well as Space. And they bring together like-minded aerospace pros across industry, academia, and government for a blend of engaging plenary sessions, in-depth Forum 360 programs, robust tech programming, and networking opportunities that jumpstart dialogues, discoveries, collaborations, and careers. Their members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous. Join us, and I say us because I am a member of AIAA. For more information, please visit AIAA.org, and I'd be willing to bet that our guest, Dr. Ben Arroyo, is also a member of AIAA. It's a great organization. And that brings me to our program today, because our guest is Dr. Chaim Ben Arroyo. So he's frequently been on the show, probably doesn't need an introduction, but he is a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Rutgers University. And he is also a noted lecturer at national and international conferences and a space advocate. He has his PhD and master's in engineering from the University of Pennsylvania. He also has space interests, which include the modeling of space and lunar-based structures, space businesses, and technology transfer, as well as the economic and political factors affecting space commerce. He has published many space-related articles and peer-reviewed publications, especially concerning lunar structures and engineering, and he has a hit book out there about the moon that we've talked about many times on the Space Show. Dr. Ben Arroyo, welcome back to the show.
Hi, David. It's great to be with you, calling from lovely New Brunswick, New Jersey, where it's nice and sunny and relatively mild for the wintertime.
Well, it may be nice and sunny and relatively mild, but you kind of sound like you're on the moon with a crappy cell phone connection, so let's hope that it holds up.
Okay.
Maybe New Jersey is in the hinterlands now. I don't know. Welcome to the show. And the last time you were on, which was, I don't know, a couple of months ago, as you were ending the discussion, you said you had an idea for a self-inflating deployable lunar space elevator, and unfortunately we were out of time, so pick up on that. What are you talking about? You really have an idea for an operational space elevator from the moon that is robotic and automatic?
Yeah, so the idea is that, first let me say that the lunar space elevator is not my idea. Is it Dr. Pearson, who wrote about it probably about almost four decades ago, and others have talked about it as well. So the basic idea is of the space elevator, as probably your listeners know, is that to avoid the high costs of launching into orbit using rockets, we would have essentially a very long ribbon that orbits either the Earth or the Moon, and that ribbon would be used to attach elevator-like structures on it that could climb it. So there would be a climber. The climber could carry supplies, and perhaps some issues were resolved, could carry people into low Earth orbit, into geosynchronous orbit, and beyond. And so, in principle, if you had these space elevators on all the planets, on the Moon or on Mars, elsewhere, then basically space elevators would be used to deploy and to land people and cargo on all these bodies. So the difficulty with a space elevator on Earth, or an Earth space elevator, is that gravity is pretty strong here, and the ribbon would have to be very strong in order to be what's expected to be about 60,000 miles long. So if you imagine that ribbon every slice of the ribbon would have to be able to support all the weight beneath it. And so the ribbon has to get thicker and thicker as it goes further and further away from the surface. So on the moon, being that the moon has 1/6 Earth gravity, that means that that ribbon could be 1/6 as massive as the one around the Earth. Around the Earth, people are anticipating that maybe using carbon nanotubes and super advanced technology materials that the ribbon can be reasonably built using these super materials. Around the moon, people think that you wouldn't have to have super materials, that perhaps some of the materials that we already have under production can be used to deploy a lunar space elevator. So a thought I had, just as an initial demonstration project, and the moon is perhaps a good place to test out concepts for space elevators as we develop stronger materials for an Earth-deployed space elevator. And I thought that maybe a nice idea would be to build that space elevator, roll it up, because a space elevator essentially is a long ribbon, and it may have some hub in the middle that holds two halves of the ribbon together. And if one can roll it up, put it into a small container, and basically launch it from Earth to lunar orbit, then perhaps it's possible to deploy it and let it unravel itself in lunar orbit at the right height, and then we would have some modest space elevator that we can start learning how to operate and use. So that's sort of the general idea of it.
Do you really think it would work? I mean, you could deploy it, but how are you going to get to it from the lunar surface, or how are you going to connect it to the lunar surface?
Right. So, in principle, the space elevators are orbital. They're like orbital satellites. So if you imagine a satellite in geosynchronous Earth orbit, it's orbiting the same spot over the Earth because of its location in orbit and just the speed and just the way it's designed to operate. So it's sitting over that point. So a space elevator would be just like a geosynchronous satellite, except it would have a ribbon hanging down from it toward the surface of the Earth and a similar length ribbon on the other side pointing outward into space. And the ribbon coming down to the surface doesn't have to be connected to the surface. I mean, you want it to come down almost to the surface, but in essence, it could be just hooked in without having a major foundation in principle, because it's not really attached to the Earth. It's just orbiting above a certain point. The moon has a different kind of gravity field, and that's something that has to be studied to see whether there are anomalies in the gravity field that make certain points over the surface better than others. The Earth generally has a similar gravitational field over all its surface. So on Earth, the deployment of the space elevator would be determined by weather patterns and whether you have hurricanes and other kinds of issues. On the moon, the gravity, the variations in the gravity would play a role in the deployment and also where you want to be over the moon. Now, it's possible to, just like a satellite, you can move it around. So in theory, it's possible to move this space elevator to different points over the lunar surface. So it doesn't really have to be connected. It might be fastened down to it, but it's really something that's orbiting the moon.
Well, you need a climber to get up to it, or some way to get up to it, right?
You do. So my thought is that the initial space elevator would not be something that could carry tremendous tons of weight, but it may be something that could be built up over time with additional thickness to the ribbons. In fact, one of the ideas of the deployment of a space elevator is to deploy ribbons one thread at a time, eventually building up that thread to a very large ribbon, and the same sort of idea could be done for a lunar space elevator.
So, but how would you get up to it? I mean, how are you going to climb up to it?
Well, you would have a climber. You'd have, so for example, if we wanted to send some material to the lunar surface, we could send a rocket to basically attach itself to the outer reaches of the lunar space elevator and then just start climbing down. So the landing process would be carried forward through the space elevator rather than a rocket landing on the lunar surface.
What would the ultimate goal of this lunar space elevator be? Would it be once you get to the to the top, you're going to launch a rocket to Mars, or what are you going to do with it?
It could be. I mean, some ideas for the space elevator would be that if you want to go from one planet to another, that you could basically have something that climbs it and then just keeps going, because, you know, you basically can go at relatively, you know, hundreds of miles per hour off the end of it, and then that capsule would then have retro rockets and would be timed so that the orbital mechanics could bring it to the next planet that you want to go. So that, I mean, that would be sort of the theoretical purpose of a space elevator. It would be to be able to take things to low geosynchronous or high orbit, or to just let the elevator, the climber, so to speak, just keep going beyond the end of it and then go to where we would want it to go. So the elevator basically takes the cost of blast offs, and makes landings a little bit more the placement of material on the surface a little bit more easily done.
How would you maintain and service it? Is all of this going to be autonomous and robotic too, or do you need people nearby to be able to repair it and such?
So the concept that I'm suggesting is basically a demonstration concept where we would learn how to deploy it, how to basically understand how it behaves in the low gravity environment of the moon. I would say that eventually, if we're talking about a lunar space elevator or any space elevator, there would have to be, you know, servicing. There would have to be ways to maintain its orbit and make sure that, say, if micrometeorites hit the ribbon, that doesn't collapse. You know, so there are a lot of issues. A lot of this stuff has been studied by many people. But ideally, one would like there to be, for example, a robotic climber that would climb back and forth on the, you know, up and down on the ribbon and would examine the ribbon to make sure that there aren't holes in it. There's a lot of research being done on self-repairing materials. And later on in the show, I know we're going to talk about inflatable structures. And one of the technologies that a lot of these space structures will depend on is that the materials can repair themselves in case they're hit by micrometeorites or there's other kinds of damage on them. So one would envision that a space elevator would also have to be pretty autonomous. I mean, nothing is 100% autonomous, but I think something that in a space environment would require more autonomy so that people would not have to climb over them all the time and look for little places of damage, which would be very difficult, if not impossible, to do.
You have your first email coming in from Sweden, and Bijan is at the other end of it. This is a Swedish elevator to the United States. So he says, most discussions about lunar resources focus on the volatiles at the pole, but a space elevator would have to be at the equator, right? And since it is in only one place, would it require extensive ground transportation to and from it? Would a space elevator pass through the L1 point, and is that a problem or an opportunity?
Well, nice to have you on board, Bijan. I would say the space elevator can really can be over any point on a planetary body. Basically, it's if one thinks of the hundreds of geosynchronous satellites orbiting the Earth, they're all at different locations around the Earth. So they basically have to be at a certain distance from the surface of the planetary body, and the ribbon then would be extended from both directions of that central point to maintain an equilibrium in the orbit. You're right that for the moon, for resource recovery, they're talking about the South Pole. So in principle, there's nothing that says that a deployed space elevator can't be moved around. So again, we're talking about a little bit of fanciful stuff right now because we can't do any of this today. But if one were to think how should it operate, then one would want to have a space elevator that basically is autonomous, self-repairing, and if necessary, can be moved around. Just like, you know, we move satellites in space. We have small rockets. We change their orbits. We raise their orbits. So a space elevator can be viewed basically as an orbital satellite, and everything that we can do to satellites should be doable to a space elevator.
Oh, you're getting hit with a tough question right off the bat, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it, even though it kind of flirts with our non-partisan political policy, but, you know, I think it's flirting with it, so I'm gonna ask it, and this is, Joe is in Hartford, and he says, I am a faithful listener to the Space Show, and I have heard you many times, as well as other Space Show guests, talk about the potential and opportunity afforded from lunar development, lunar structures, all sorts of great things that could be done on the moon and that are within our technical capability now or almost there. That is, we have a high TRL level even today. Dr. Doug, for example, Paul Spoutis, for example, John Strickland, you've been on many, many times. All of this is great, except we don't have any political leaders anywhere that I know of that even think along the lines of all of you guys that advocate what can be done on the moon now or in the very near future and why it should be there. Some of you make a better case than others, but all of you are on the same page, and I am on that page with you. But if you look, for example, at who is likely to be the next president of the United States and what the issues are between a Hillary Clinton, a Ted Cruz, a Donald Trump, and who knows who else might get in the fray, do you really think there's going to be any lunar space development program any time in the next decade? Where is the money going to come from? Where is the political policy and the leadership going to come from? I see us stuck in worse than a status quo place, and I don't see anybody that is going to lead this country, and lead is a very generous term, that can take us into developing the moon or doing anything other than status quo and make busy work to keep people employed in the space program, unless someone decides to kill a big segment of the space program thinking that the money they're going to save can go fill potholes or something else. Do you really have any optimism left that we're going to be able to do something on the moon like you and others talk about?
So that's a great question, and I share your sense of, questioning when is this ever going to take off. And, David and I have known each other since the late 80s, and we've been through the ups and downs of all the different presidents coming in and proposing projects and going to the moon. It was the first George Bush, and then we had the second George Bush, and
you had Clinton, and you had a lot of stuff in between.
A lot of stuff, yeah. So you know, we've been doing it for 30, going on 40 years, and, whereas there has been advances in technologies, individual technologies, and even space capabilities, I think one can say that that one example of success has been the beginning of the private sector in space. So all these private sector businesses are really building off the shoulders of what the civil space program, perhaps the military space program, have developed. So unfortunately, it's hard to get political support for this, and people like the idea of space as a concept, and they believe that we're spending much more on space than we actually are, and there are very few politicians who have any leadership at all on not only on space but on almost any issue anyway. Their big issue is really to get reelected, right? We know that. So I guess you know, people like me, like David, like yourself, really. I don't want to say believe, because belief sort of implies faith. I would say who are part of the effort to build our capabilities and to support the building of those capabilities. Our task has to be that we carry forth that, ability to the next generation. And so we all have different kinds of jobs, right? So David promotes these ideas through this show and in other ways. I promote these ideas through students at Rutgers where I teach and do research. And I've mentioned it in earlier shows, but every year I get two or three freshmen who come to me, they want to do research on space, and they say, that's why I'm studying engineering. And so So in my view, in addition to any research I may do that may be of value, these students are the legacy to the next generation. So they're carrying forward that belief and that ability that says space is important in many ways. So, you know, I agree that the current mix of candidates don't talk about space, but space is not a big topic given all the other problems that they're talking about. And I think that at some point, one of these candidates, one of these presidents will understand that investing in space, just like investing in the Apollo program, had large benefits to the country. In the book that David mentioned that I wrote a number of years ago, there's a chart that shows how funding for Apollo and tracked almost completely with a number of American PhDs coming out and graduate degrees in engineering and math. Apollo funding went up, number of PhDs went up. Apollo funding went down, number of PhDs went down. So obviously all those PhDs didn't go work in the space program, but even if only 5% worked in the space program, the other 95% went to work in American industry. And so all those industries benefited by the attraction that space had for a lot of Americans, and that attraction got translated into studying engineering and math and science and other things that impact all of our society. So, you know, so I guess the short answer is, you know, I'm not necessarily optimistic. I guess I'm sort of seeing that after all these decades that there is a reasonable private space effort that is slow, still depends on government funding to a great extent, but eventually we'll be able to find niches where they can be profitable.
Joe sent in a follow-up during your answer, and he said, David, I did not intend to violate your partisan politics rule for the show, and I just want everybody to know that I am not partisan in my comments. I am condemning our overall political process, both parties, and every known possible candidate for president in 2016. So he gave me a clarification.
Yeah, partisan question either. Condemnation.
I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands that this is not directed at any one individual, any one party, that this is a wholesale condemnation I guess maybe the mood of the country right now. Well, maybe some of these other people are listening to the show and they'll chime in on this too, because, you know, no one wants to feel that they're doing useless busy work. So you've got a great idea for a deployable lunar space elevator, which probably, what, in a timeline, if it had funding and could, you know, really be developed, it could be launched in, what, 5 to 7 years maybe?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Okay.
Easily. We're not talking about anything that's more complicated than what we already do in space. And I am looking for funding for that. So I'm looking to develop the underlying engineering aspects and then sending it there. It'll orbit, and then we'll be able to learn a lot from it.
Well, that's what I mean. No one wants to do busy work and just, you know, like they're blowing it out in the wind. You want to see something happen with this. And, you know, Doug, who has great ideas on lunar structures, he'd like to see some action taken on designing some lunar structures. And Sputus has been, you know, preaching on this stuff and doing science and engineering and economics for as long as I've known Paul, for as long as I've known you. Nobody wants to be wasting their time and do busy work. So, and everybody seems to understand the dilemma. And so I guess what everybody is doing is the work and passing it on for future generations. I mean, what else can you stop?
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, those of us who live between Apollo and today are in a location where we won't see much of our efforts to get to the product that we want to see, like a lunar base or a Mars base or a space elevator. But we know that it's going to happen. And so when that starts to go, then people are going to go back and look at all the published papers and the books and things, and they're going to see a lot of analysis and a lot of discussion, and they'll pick up from where we leave off. And that's really how this is really a very long term effort, and we may just not see it in our lifetimes, but that's how it goes, you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say though that it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of good stuff happening regarding space. It's smaller, but capabilities are developing, and a lot of the capabilities that are being developed by NASA and the Air Force in other countries will eventually get to be used. The other point I would make is that we're not in a static political environment. I mean, it's not just this country's politics, right? There are other countries that have expressed an interest in going to the moon and placing settlements and putting people there, as well as Mars and other kinds of space ventures. You know, that you have the Chinese, you have the Russians, you have the Europeans, the Japanese, the Koreans. There's a lot of countries with space that are space capable, and they view space as a prestigious thing. And so, you know, we may not view space as prestigious, but other countries that are developing do view it as prestigious, both from a civilian and military perspective. And so, unfortunately, you know, well, Apollo was really a Cold War child, right? So
right.
It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the Cold War. So it may be that unfortunately, you know, wars and military have basically accelerated technological development since the dawn of man. And so I wouldn't be surprised if other countries now start becoming space capable and we view it as a military threat, and then that will force us to move faster. You know, so it's not going to be purely a civilian political decision. It'll be in reaction to other things happening around the world.
You have a caller on hold, but I want to do this one email because I think you'll probably give a rather short reply to this. So Harry is in New Orleans, and Harry says, Dr. Benaroya, using a scale of 1 to 10, how much easier is it to do a lunar elevator and lunar structures than a Mars elevator and Mars structures?
I would say lunar is probably no more than 10% the difficulty of a Mars. So, in other words, Mars is at least 10 times as difficult if we're including humans in it, just because of the distance, because of our inability to keep people alive in space, with some guarantee for such long flights and such long duration activities in space. So I think whatever we can do for the moon, you know, with people, is going to be 10 to 100 times more difficult to do for Mars.
Okay. Let's see who your caller is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Okay, Kim, go ahead.
Well, first I have a question, and then I think I'd like to comment on where the conversation has been going in the last few minutes. But first, because space elevator on the moon going through one of the Lagrange points, for instance, is so huge, wouldn't it make a lot of sense to do a rotating tether first that could be much shorter?
Perhaps. So I can't give you a definitive answer because I haven't really analyzed the rotating tether. It appears to me, and I could be wrong, that the space elevator, once it's deployed, is a relatively static structure, even though it's orbiting. And a rotating tether, it's more dynamic and may need more control. The rotating tether, to my understanding, basically would pick up and drop off stuff on the surface. Is that the way that it's supposed to operate?
Yeah, I had read a paper fairly recently by Tethers Unlimited, and they did an analysis for NASA, I think within the last 10 or 15 years, and they were focusing on a low lunar orbit rotating tether that would only be a couple of hundred kilometers long and, would on each orbit be able to touch down at different locations on the equator. And it seemed like something that would take a lot less material because the Lagrange points, I can't see how you do it without going through a Lagrange point, one way or another. You know, they're not particularly stable. They move around because of the way that the moon's orbit is, and you also mentioned the variations in the moon's gravity field. And, you know, in some ways you have that stability, it gives you a bit more maneuverability, maybe, but it also has to be huge, and it's still going to have to move around a fair bit.
Yeah, I don't disagree with everything you're saying, and I'm not against the concept that you're describing. I'm thinking that this rotating tether is really meant to. I mean, it has a similar purpose. I'm not sure how I would compare it to the space elevator. I don't think the space elevator necessarily would have to have a lot more mass than the kind of structure you're describing, in that the initial tether would probably be a very, very thin, small tether. And so even if it's 10,000 miles long or however long it has to be, we're still not talking about a lot of material. I think the rotating tether would most likely have to be stronger. So because when it's rotating, even if it's not rotating super fast, you still have a lot of stresses on it because of the rotation. Most likely larger stresses than for one that's just hanging there. So I would have to do an analysis to compare. I don't object to that concept. I just hadn't thought about it very much.
Sure. I mean, actually, that paper doesn't have, you know, they don't show the mass. It's a summary paper, and I kind of wish I knew more about it myself as well. But
I think that definitely you'd have larger stresses on something that's rotating versus something that's just hanging there because of the dynamics. And so it's unclear to me that it would necessarily be less mass. But again, one would have to do an engineering study to make that comparison.
Kim, do you have the paper?
Oh, I think if you searched for Tethers Unlimited, it would probably come up really quickly. I do have it bookmarked, but I didn't pull it up.
No, I'm just wondering if you can send me where it is.
Sure.
I know the people at Tethers Unlimited. They haven't been on the show for quite a while, but maybe it's time to bring them back.
I also wanted to comment.
Say again, Kim, what is it?
No, Kim was going to make a statement about something as well.
Oh, yeah. Regarding the likelihood of action on major space development in the future.
Wait, hold on, Kim. You cut out, so can you repeat yourself, please?
Sorry, I hope my connection isn't degrading.
It is, but try again. Say it and start over again, okay?
Okay. Regarding the idea that maybe space development is stuck in the doldrums because it has been for so long, I think the thing is that we've gotten so used to that and we think that it can't change quickly, but it can change quickly. It just needs the right nudge. And I think the circumstances that could create that nudge could happen really quickly in the near future, both because what Chaim said, that there are a lot of other countries on the map now, and also because of what's happening in the private sector and our capabilities are quickly changing, but also because I just don't think anybody has properly presented this to the general public yet. You know, there's a lot of material out there, but it mostly appeals to people who are already space nerds. What we need is material out there that appeals to the general public and gets them enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you've said, and I think that it's incumbent about all of for all of us, you know, yourself, David already does, other people. I think if you support this sort of activity, you should find some venue where you express that to other people. You know, that could be talking to kids in elementary school. It could be talking to your friends more about it. You know, I think if you can convince even a few people every year that this is really important and convince them also to pass it on, then I think you can have a lot of people who are more aware. You know, there are probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in this country who really support space, but But first of all, they're not politically active, and they probably aren't in the midst of the work that's involved. So they may listen and say, this is a great idea, but that's where it ends. And so unless they talk to their congressman, or unless they make political activism part of that support, then it's hard. The politicians aren't going to really do much with it unless there's a significant number of people who support it. And that, and again, the politicians care about getting reelected initially, and so they go where where the demand is. You know, demand for this program or that program or some message. So those have to become the message, and then I think there may be some chance for more support. And even though the president is, you know, whoever the president will be, you know, that president has a lot of power as to where things go. And we see it with the current president, who basically shut down Constellation, and he could do it because he's president, by just forcing budget changes and where he wants to put his money. And the president has a lot of power, and I think that the flaw with President Bush and his plan, which was a reasonable plan, was that it never got carried through. So after he announced it in 2004, the funding couldn't keep up with what NASA needed to do the project fast enough, and had he supported it with enough funding, then by the time President Obama came into office, things would have been much further along, and it would have been much harder to cancel the program that he did. So I think there's this problem. Space takes so long to create the technology and to test it and to then implement it, that even if you had a president who supported it, and that president was in power for 8 years, that's pretty much how much time you would need to really get from, you know, where we are now to something that's, you know, viable to bring people back to the moon. So it's a real challenge.
Kim?
Well, I agree. It is a big challenge, but I think the big difference is the general public. What do you think?
You're degrading, Kim. We're losing you.
Okay.
Thank you for the call, Kim.
Thank you.
Maybe the advocates should get placards and take to the streets and block traffic and yell and scream and you know, pick up the anti. What could that get you in front of all the TV cameras? I mean, whatever we're doing doesn't get us in front of TV cameras.
That's true. I never thought of that. Maybe we should hold signs at the next Trump
Return
rally.
To the moon or bust, or you know, or whatever. We need to go to Mars and block streets and traffic and raise holy hell and have a lunar flag or a Martian flag and try to get airtime. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a hard thing, right? I mean, now they're talking all the things on TV are about this event or that event, and very little on policy. And
well,
very
that's what I'm saying. Since they're not interested in policy and long-term thinking and anything that requires a brain to report, you know, they're just looking for antics. Then maybe the space advocates should have an antics division for our advocacy, and figure out how we can be disruptive with our antics to get on the different shows and get our 5 minutes of fame to make our case.
Well, I know that Kim was talking about things changing rapidly. You know what would change things rapidly? If somebody from the outer reaches of the solar system all of a sudden orbits Earth and lands in the White House, and then I think space becomes very important.
Well, if you follow the UFO world, that has already happened, my friend.
I don't see any evidence. I'd like to see some evidence.
Well, they claim that reptilians have been inhabiting the White House. I don't want to go there for the show.
Okay.
But I know that world because I've said to listeners before, I'm really interested in UFOs. I just don't do it on the show. But the reptilians have been occupying the politicians and the White House, and this is not just in the United States but around the world for years and years and years, and that's why things are always so sour, because the reptilians are not nice. But
okay,
you know,
yeah,
a lot of folk culture out there. So
I guess so.
So you see the moon definitely as the beginning point, the training ground where we're going to go to learn, and the moon is an entirely big demo project from what I understand from talking to you. It's not just you're going to have a demo space elevator, a lunar elevator there. everything you're doing on the moon is a demo for elsewhere in the solar system.
That's right. That's right. There's no way that we can get to Mars if Mars is our initial large goal, unless we go through the moon. So the moon is where we can actually build structures. We can test how humans react to low gravity, how to shield against radiation, micrometeorites, how to build things, how to test our robotics, how to take the local resources and manufacture from that, how to extract the elements. All these things, really, we're so lucky to have a moon that's 3 days flying time from the Earth that we can observe and we can communicate almost in real time, that it's almost ridiculous to think that we can bypass it and do the same thing on Mars. As far as I know, it can't be done today. You know, we can easily say that the moon is doable today, even though there's a lot to learn and survive through. Mars doesn't seem to be doable today when we're talking about humans. I mean, the statistic I always tell people is that of all the spacecraft that we've sent to Mars to land and to orbit, only 50% survived the trip, meaning that they didn't bypass Mars or crash. 50% is not a great percentage if you have humans there. So my feeling is that if we're going to send humans to another body and figure out how to do this, you know, being a spacefaring civilization, we really have to go to the moon. And people who say been there, done that, really don't understand what we've done, you know, so, and what we still have to do in order to survive in space.
I want to take a break in a few minutes, but there are other kinds of structures and things that go on the moon, and you've done some great programming with us on the space show in the past, but what other type of structures, again, we're looking down the road for humans, would be self-deployable so that you could get them up and running robotically or automatically without having to put humans on the moon in order to build, you know, the first habitat, even if it's on the surface? Can you have it, like, ready to go, turnkey, like you're going to plop down a prefabricated trailer, one of these, you know, prefabricated steel buildings you hear advertised on the TV, you know, or wherever, so you can have your warehouse and, you know, any contractor can assemble it real quickly. But can you plop down your village and have it deploy and then send your humans there and then walk right into a functioning village?
Right. There are various concepts that people have talked about. So the one where you just plop down the structure probably will be, you know, a circular cylinder where it's pressurized and we just land it there and people can walk right in and use it. So that's the most likely scenario so far. But people who are into ISRU, in situ resource utilization, also have the idea that maybe we can send robots that can go to the moon, start processing the materials that are in the lunar soil, and then start building it using 3D or layered manufacturing and basically build that whole framework of a structure that people can come to and put the final touches on. Because one thing is quite certain, and that is that astronauts don't make good construction workers. It's not possible to have people in a spacesuit start moving heavy equipment and putting stuff together. We saw how difficult that was for the space station. There's no way that's going to happen on the moon. So if we want to go beyond that initial pressurized cylinder where we have larger expanses of habitable volumes, then we're going to have to use local materials. We're probably going to use 3D printed technologies, and we're probably going to use inflatable structures. So the advantage of the inflatable structure is that, first of all, you can fold it into a very small volume, and it's not very heavy, and you can just shoot it off into space and take it to the moon and inflate it, and then you, all of a sudden, once you inflate it, and there's a lot that goes to this, obviously, but once you inflate it, then you can actually have a large volume to work with, and you pressurize it, and then you build your structure, and there's a whole host of technologies that go along with that. But that's an area that's actually been in development since the Apollo era. You know, the inflatable structures, Goodyear had among the first research on inflatable structures, and there are other companies as well who have focused on that technology. In fact, David, you and I know, remember Willy Sade, who was a big person in the space conference circuit in the 90s.
Right.
Also had a concept for an inflatable structure.
That's Eligard's father, for those of you who end up connecting the name to our current guest that we have on
That's
all
right.
the time, Elagar.
That's
today.
Right. Uh-huh. So the inflatable structure is one big idea, that's also been in development for a long time. And then more recently, with all the advances in 3D printing technologies and robotics, and I guess the vision is that at some point we could merge or marry the two technology areas, you know, getting local resources, 3D printing, and robotics, and have it all be done for us a year in advance of people arriving, and then the astronauts would then put final touches, and there's your city, your initial city on the moon.
What about radiation shielding and environmental protection with an inflatable structure on the surface of the moon?
Right, so almost all structures on the surface of the moon would eventually have to be covered with regolith. So the idea is that you probably would need to put on the order of 10 feet thick regolith on top of the structure, and that would shield against most radiation and most micrometeorites. The inflatable structures that were developed for space like Transhab have a lot of layers of different kinds of materials and composites that absorb a lot of the radiation, prevent it from going through. So it's possible that some advances in material technology could release us from the need to cover the structures with so much regolith. But the simple way, quote unquote, simple way without advances in materials would be to just cover them up.
Can you cover them up robotically? Would we be able to have robots or some other way bury them in the regolith?
Yeah, that would be the way it would be done. In fact, there are some images of Boeing concepts where they show regolith being vacuumed through tubes from the surface to the top of the structure. And some people talk about just dumping the regolith on top. Other people talk about putting regolith in so-called sandbags and laying them on top. And there's a concept from Orbital Sciences that shows basically like a cylindrical shell structure, like a soup can looking shell. And it has basically space within the walls where you would put regolith. And so that regolith, you wouldn't see it, but it would be between the walls, the inside and outside wall of the structure. And that would provide some shielding as well. So there are other concepts. NASA has concepts because regolith is also a lot of the radiation can be perhaps deflected using all kinds of electromagnetic techniques. So there are technologies. None of them is fully developed. The regolith seems to be the low-tech, highly effective way to initially shield people from radiation and micrometeorites.
Bobby is in Memphis, Tennessee. And he said the regolith is toxic. We know that from the Apollo era history. So if you're using regolith around the habitats where humans are going to be, isn't that a possibility of exposing them to a more toxic level of regolith than just if it's on the lunar surface and they go out for an excursion?
Absolutely. The regolith is toxic, carcinogenic, and it's one of the big questions to be solved. And NASA had created a group that has met over a couple of years to try to get a handle on this problem. It's not a solved problem at all. As Bobby mentioned, the regolith is a very fine dust-like powder, but it also is extremely sharp and jagged. There are probably unoxidized atoms and elements on it, and because it's so small, it can be breathed in, it can get into machinery. We know that we had problems with it during Apollo. The other thing about the regolith is that it's electrostatically charged, which means that when it's kicked around, it floats. If you look at photographs of the astronauts walking on the lunar surface, you see a fine fog. That fog is basically regolith that is electrostatically charged and just floats around for quite a bit of time and migrates across structures and is a real problem. So it is one of the big problems. It's not solved. People have some ideas on how to do it because it's electrostatically charged. Some think that one could use magnetic fields to contain it, deflect it. But Bobby's exactly right. It's one of the big issues.
Bijan in Sweden has another note, and I will say Dr. Doug sent in an email, but it's way too long to read on air, so I've asked Doug to shorten it or to give us a call. And if he does that, I'll put the other version on out for everybody. And if he calls, I'll be happy to take his phone call. This is from Bijan again in Sweden. Wouldn't it be easier to send humans to the moons of Mars than to Luna? I guess that means our moon. One wouldn't have to land in a gravity well, and it would be a greater advance for both spaceflight and science.
Well, I think whether it's Mars or the moons of Mars, we're still talking a very long flight. And so my concern is that from everybody who I talk to who is a medical doctor, they basically point to a lot of issues that we haven't resolved as to how to keep people safe for such long flights. Remember, we're talking about almost a year flight out, almost a year flight back, and then however time you want to spend there. So we're talking 2 to 3 years of in space, in low gravity environment, in high radiation environment. Just the complexity of shielding the astronauts during space flight from the radiation is significant. It's less significant going to the moon because the astronauts will be going to a facility where they could be shielded relatively quickly. Mars is a big issue. The other thing is we don't know how the human body will react to such long excursions in low gravity. We just saw, you know, the recent astronaut come back from the space station. He did pretty well. He was only there under a year. We're talking 3 years to Mars, so it's unclear why we would want to skip by the moon. Mars may be more exciting. I don't know. I think I'd be as excited going to the moon as going to Mars, personally. But I understand that Mars is in our future. One thing I would not like to see is that we go to Mars before we're ready to, and then something happens, and then everybody backs off from space, just like we backed off when we had the Challenger disaster. We don't want to. I mean, we know space is risky, but when we know what those risks are, it's incumbent upon us to try to minimize those risks. Pushing through the risks doesn't make sense. Doesn't mean we have to be super, super careful, but we want to be as careful as possible to keep the risks within bounds because we're sending people there, and we know that if something happens, everybody in the U.S. will then say, why are we doing this? And then we're worse off than if we didn't try at all.
Okay, listeners, we're about an hour into the program, so I'm going to pause us for our break right here with Dr. Ben Arroyo as our guest, and we'll be back in 3 minutes, so please don't go anywhere. And if you are going to give us a call when we come back from the break, it is 1-866-687-7223 and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't go anywhere. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part 2 of our Sunday Space Show program with Professor Chaim Ben Arroyo, mechanical engineering tenured professor from Rutgers University. And we have two sponsors for this segment of our program, Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, is the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And Integrated Space Analytics is also a sponsor, and they have the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a space-faring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. Join discussions, see regular updates, and participate in exclusive interactive features. You can order your own full-color poster of the plan in one of two sizes. It's a useful and inspiring tool that should be on the wall of everyone serious about space development. Remember, their website is thespaceplan.com. Email for our show today is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Remember, if you're on our website, you can certainly comment on the blog, and we will get those comments. In fact, I have one to read to you in just a minute. And our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Kim in Mexico is using the blog to comment. And Kim says, about Mars before the moon, while I understand the enthusiasm for Mars, would we also think there was no more science or development to do there if we sent 18 people there for a total of about 2 weeks? Chaim?
Yeah.
Do you want to comment on the same
topic? You broke up a little bit.
You want me to read her comment again?
Yeah, please. Sorry.
Okay, it's very short. About Mars before the moon, while I understand the enthusiasm for Mars, would we also think there was no more science or development to do there if we send 18 people there for a total of about 2 weeks?
To Mars? 18?
Yeah. So what she said, people say we don't need to go to the moon. We've already been there, done that. And so what she's saying is, would we feel the same way if we went to Mars and only sent 18 people there for 2 weeks?
Right. I think Kim makes a good point that the current plans for Mars really are short kinds of visits, not something that would lead to a permanent settlement either. And while there's obviously things to learn on Mars with a short visit, it's hardly worth the huge effort that it would take to get there. I'd rather see all that effort go back to the moon for a permanent stay and then use the moon to be the launch point for the rest of the solar system.
We have a caller on hold, and hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please, and where are you?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah. The I guess the overall proposal, I tend to be much more favorable to the inflatable structures approach, but the bringing the space elevator into it looks to me like we're talking two different generations of technology, basically. That we could do a moon base with inflatable structures using something more conventional with rockets and so forth much sooner than we could even begin to think about a space elevator even on the moon.
Yeah, and I would agree with you, John. I think that the space elevator would be a next generation kind of concept, and we don't need a space elevator to get to the moon and put structures there and put people there. It could be something that's useful later on. But I guess I only mentioned the lunar space elevator as just an interesting thing to develop to keep some interest in different space technologies, but I would definitely vote for a conventional transport to the moon with structures and people.
Yeah, because I remember years ago, I was a lot younger, in a movie called 2001, A Space Odyssey, and that moon base they had there, and I'm like, you know, I'm in high school at the time I'm watching this.
Moon Base Alpha.
What?
Moon Base Alpha.
Yeah. And they were, at any rate, they had this elaborate structure there where they landed the spacecraft and took, I'm thinking, how could you possibly build something like this on the moon? I mean, without, it would just take, you know, the the idea of, you know, building something like conventional structures with humans in spacesuits out there doing construction labor is just mind-boggling. The troubles it would have doing it, I think.
Yeah, even a much simpler kind of structure would have to be done more or less autonomously. We were talking about the lunar dust, the toxicity, all the machines that we have on Earth for building large structures wouldn't work on the moon because all of our Earth-based moving machines, they're all based on 1G gravity to hold them in place. You put them on the moon, they're just going to be pushing themselves off the surface all the time. So the whole concept of building on the moon from a construction engineering point of view would have to be very different. We also know that the regolith on the moon is highly compact, much more compact than sites on Earth. And so just digging that out would be a serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, lady was talking about Mars thing. The stay would probably have to be a lot more than 2 weeks if you go to the moons of Jupiter because of the launch windows to come back, would be
right. That's
probably
right. Launch windows
over a year,
of Mars
become conventional,
very critical. Yeah, absolutely
so,
right.
That makes that very challenging and not the near term objective, I would say.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that people who say Mars first really. I'm not sure why they're doing it, because many of them know better, and perhaps they're doing it because they feel that the only way that they can generate political support. But, in my view, I don't want political support for something that I don't think is the right thing to do, because if anything goes wrong, then that will put us back decades. I'd rather take it slower and do it the right way.
Haim, I interview these people all the time, and I really disagree with you. I think... In fact, I know they believe that we can go directly to Mars, that, yes, you can go to the moon, yes, you can learn things, but it is clearly not necessary. And if Mars is the ultimate brass ring goal, then that's what we should be doing. And there is this whole cadre of people from the Mars Society, the people I have on the show tomorrow from Explore Mars, that are a very good Mars advocacy organization, probably in my mind the best one there is, with Explore Mars. Chris Carberry, for example, is exceptional. And they don't see the moon as being essential, although they're okay about going to the moon with the proviso that you don't get bogged down there, which they believe is a big risk, and then you don't do anything else for decades, kind of like orbiting in the space station. So, look, if Mars is a goal, go to Mars. And if you talk to Bob Zubrin and other people and you say, what about going to the moons of Mars? Hell no. If Mars is a goal, then that's where you go. And we can do that now, and we can handle the human factors and the radiation and the this and the that. And, it's not that they know better. They believe that this is the soundest approach, and that we are technically capable of doing it, and if this is what our goal is, this is what we should do.
Okay, well, I would say that Mars is not the goal, Moon is not the goal. The goal is to become a spacefaring civilization, and if we look at the long-term vision of humans in space, then Mars is not the end of it, is it? Neither is the Moon.
Well, but so their goal, I think they would differ with you on the goal. Maybe I'll ask that to Chris and the group tomorrow.
What about all the human issues? What about all
the they think they're either going to be solved or they're doable, or they believe that people should be allowed and enabled to take risk. And if they want to take the risk of getting cancer down the road because they may get a little bit more radiation here or there or something else, then that should be, an individual's choice. It should not be regulated to being something you can't do. I mean, they have a different mindset about this than what you're expressing and what a lot of other people express.
I guess it depends on whether this is government-funded or private sector. If private sector wants to go ahead and do it, if they indemnify everybody from any liability, then go ahead and do it. But I don't think it's going to solve the issue of becoming a permanent resident on the Moon or Mars. I mean, the plan that they're talking about, I mean, one plan is to send people there to basically live or die on their own, you know, their abilities to live off the land. And the others are talking about relatively short missions, and then they come back. So how does that get us to Mars? I don't see any plan where there's permanent settlement of Mars in these plans. Is there a permanent settlement of Mars?
Well, they haven't. And look, if are you going to go to the IAC in Guadalajara in September? Because you go to that conference from time to time.
I'm not going to that one. I was in Jerusalem for the last one.
Okay, so Elon Musk is announcing his plans to Mars at that September conference. So,
okay.
You know, have you ever debated Zubrin, or I know you haven't debated Elon Musk, but have you ever debated these people that are talking about Mars differently than what we're talking about on the show today?
No. I remember that maybe like 20 years ago, one of the space, ASCE space conferences, there was a debate, and I think at that time, I think that Harrison Schmitt was on the other side for Mars, and this is maybe 1995, 98, I don't remember exactly the date, but I was on the moon side with one or two people, and he was on the other side with one or two people, and I think Mars won that debate, but, you know, I think there are a lot of issues that are just basically solved via hand-waving.
Mars will always win the debate if the person advocating for Mars can wave their hands and speak a complete sentence. Because
right.
Mars is exciting, it's new, it's thrilling, it has a special place in our culture, in science fiction, in our history, our literature, that the moon does not have. And you know, people aren't as excited about the potential of going to the moon. They're not going to the moon to find life. People think that we might find life on Mars, or past life, or past structures. I mean, you know, Mars has invoked everything, including, you know, organized structures like, you know, the face on Mars and stuff like that.
Right.
So Mars wins every time. As long as the debate guy or gal can wave their hands real well and speak a coherent sentence, I don't see how a lunar person stands a chance in a Mars debate.
Right. I'm talking if we have a rational debate where we can invoke engineering, science, medicine, and logic, and cost, then I think.
Well, you won't have an audience then, because who the hell wants to sit through an engineering class or an economics class? Because that's basically what you're talking about.
But I think having a discussion like we're having here, where we bring up issues that are unresolved, you can't just shrug them off.
No, you know? I agree. And by the way, I'm on your side of the fence.
I know you are, but that's a good discussion to have.
But I do know the mentality and the thought process of the Mars people. Look, there's a group of people that are very well respected that come on the space show all the time, and you know them as well as Jim Logan and Dan Adamo, and they have a terrific plan for going to the moons of Mars. And even going to the moons of Mars is crapped on by those who want to go to Mars, because, again, if we're going to Mars, then the goal ought to be to go to Mars and not to the moons of Mars. End of story. And yet you can't fault the engineering, the science, the life science, you know, the orbital stuff and everything of Logan's and Adamo's plan. It's really a good plan to go to. Mostly they're supportive of Deimos more than Phobos. Listen to me, Phobos. But you know, that's dismissed too by the we're going to go to Mars crowd. And even when I asked Chris and others about going to the moons of Mars, well, that's okay. But if the goal is to get to Mars, that's what we need to be doing.
I guess the question is, whose goal is it? You know, it's not just one. Doesn't have to be one space program. If Elon Musk wants to go to Mars and he wants to do it on his dime or investors' dime, then by all means, go ahead and do it. You know, nobody should stop them. I think, though, if we're talking about taxpayer-supported long-range missions, then we have to base it on some sort of rational decision-making. And, what would the cost factor be going to Mars versus going to the moon with people? 10 times more expensive to go to Mars. Who's going to pay for that? You know, if you're going to send people on one-way mission and not care if they survive, well, that's a different kind of mission. So I think I guess we have to sort of set up what are the goals. The goals are permanent habitats in space somewhere. And in my view and your view and many people who I respect views, the moon is the only choice for a dozen reasons that are unresolved. And we can't start planning to send people to Mars, say tomorrow, you know, and hope that all the problems that exist are going to be solved along the way. What if they're not solved along the way? We were talking about, you know, different windows of opportunity to fly to Mars and to fly back. You know, it's not like we can move the flight by a week and then go to Mars. You know, there are a lot of issues that are unresolved, and the whole point of the moon, which I think is just as exciting as Mars for many reasons, scientific and otherwise, then we're not really solving the problem. You know, why don't we say, how about let's go to Jupiter? You know, Jupiter is much more exciting than Mars, you know, or Venus. Venus is much more exciting than
Mars.
Well,
but they claim we have a TRL for Mars, and there's no such thing for Jupiter. John, do you have anything more that you want to contribute to this rant?
I definitely would say that the moon would be the more viable thing to do in the near term, just because, I mean, it's clearly within our capabilities, relatively speaking. The Mars thing, like I say, if you do Mars, in reality, you're talking about a sort of like an Apollo-like program to put a human being on Mars.
A flagship program is what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not going to lead to a long-term presence on Mars, and given the distance and times involved, it's going to be very infrequent. I mean, maybe one or two or three missions at incredible expense, and then it ends, and now what have we? Well, we'll have some scientific data from Mars, I suppose. We may have some insight into that whole issue about whether aliens actually explode the nuclear bomb on there that we had in the previous show. But, you know, I mean, whatever, there's life or whatever. There probably will be life on Mars after we go there, because we will probably deposit some. But I don't think it's really cost-effective at this point compared to developing a real space capability to go to the moon and develop there.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the concept. I think it was a Dallas Beinhoff that had on the lunar program of how to build kind of reusable vehicles to go from Earth orbit to the moon and back. And it was a very interesting concept of how you might start developing cislunar development, you know.
Yeah, he was on a long time ago. I don't know if I can get him back on. Boeing has a different policy now, so.
I see. I'm just saying that kind of an idea of building a craft that uses aerobraking to return to the Earth, you know, and so forth, is reusable, would be a way to sort of develop at least a near-term ability to build lunar bases and so forth. I mean,
okay,
that's kind of like my thinking on it, but. Like you say, I guess if Elon Musk can raise the money to go to Mars and wants to do it, I'd be all for seeing how he does. I mean,
well, we're going to find out in September.
Yeah.
Give him our salute in that case if he wants to do it. But
yep. All right, anything else, John? Otherwise, I'll clear the line.
Okay.
Thank you.
All for now.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
I have a shorter version of the email from Doug, which I'll see if I can read on air. The success of current public-private programs indicate we don't have to give in to cynicism, okay? Even if presidents don't care about space, they always do set a direction for NASA. We've seen that Obama supported commercial space, and it has gone well. He didn't support lunar development, so that hasn't moved forward. But this illustrates that things can change. If we propose concepts which are either too expensive or too technically difficult, then of course we're going to be waiting forever. That's why I advocate lunar cots to congressmen and the space advisors for the presidential campaign. In life, there are no certainties, but there are probabilities. So it is our job as space advocates to do what we can to increase the probability of remarkable achievements in space. It beats just sitting on our duff complaining to each other.
Right, and I agree that if we care about this, then we should take opportunities to promote it and to do our best to promote it in whatever circles that we travel in. And if we're able to write coherent letters and documents, then we should send those to our congressmen and those things carry weight, and if enough of us do it, then we'll have an impact over time. I think that's really the right way to go.
So if Joe in Hartford is still listening to the show, I don't know why I'm getting feedback all of a sudden. Why the hell am I getting feedback? If Joe in Hartford is listening to the show, I hope that you will email in a follow-up now that I have read Doug's email. And tell us what you think, okay? Because it's really directed at you and the school of thought that you represented on the show today. And we have a caller. Chaim, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I thought I lost you. We have a caller on the line, I believe. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay. You're on a crappy line, too, so make it quick.
Okay. I was wondering if they've ever thought about talking with some of these private companies that are trying to go to the moon, like Shepard and Crater. Just to get off the phone now, okay?
Well, no, hold on a minute.
Okay.
You're okay. Chaim, have you talked to any of the companies like Shackleton and others that want to do lunar ventures?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've read the various venture ideas, but I haven't really communicated with them.
I've interviewed a lot of them. As you know, Doug, I think some are more feasible than others. And, you know, they're all positive. They believe much more on the order of what Doug represents than what Joe in Hartford represents. And they also are attempting to self-fund. Well, they're raising capital, but I'm using that as self-funding rather than getting public money. And they believe that if they can finance their ventures, then they can do this, and you know, there isn't any need for government policy, unless government policy were to say no private activities going to the moon, but I don't foresee that happening.
Yeah, I'm all for private ventures, because a lot of stuff can be learned by doing that. I don't believe private ventures are very close to sending people for long-term space missions or to the moon. But, you know, it certainly is the private sector in space is certainly much more advanced today than it was even 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And there are a number of private ventures for both hardware as well as humans to the moon, and we'll see if any can materialize. Shackleton is so awfully costly. I put that on the skeptical side, just because of the quantity of funds that are needed for their game plan. But others are less costly, so we'll see what they can develop. Tim, what else do you have to say?
They mentioned something about the space elevator. I was wondering if they also looked at probably a mass driver.
I've read some papers on the mass driver. So that would be a mass driver that would be on the lunar surface and would then shoot stuff into orbit, right?
Orbit's one place. The other better one would be the L1, because if you shoot at the right speed, it'll be the cargo will be coming in like a couple of meters per second, slow enough to be caught by a net.
Okay, yeah. I think I've seen people refer to that as well. And others suggest a surface mass driver on the moon to just move stuff between distant locations on the surface as a way to get around the surface as well.
If you wanted to coming down on your head at high speeds, yeah, it'd be like a cannon. It's designed to lob shells on one side of the planet to the other. It's just you probably just better off building a road system and delivering everything from place to place. Someone discovered something interesting. They discovered that they can take lunar stimulant and then apply a microwave beam to it, and it glassifies.
Yeah, there has been research. I guess you're talking about roads, yeah, to use microwave sintering to basically make it rigid in place, and then that could become a road system.
also with all the problem about the lunar regolith and all the dust. They just make the area around it, classify the area around it, and you don't have to worry about lunar dust so much.
Right. That is a promising thing, and others have studied the using the regolith without processing it at all and making building blocks out of it. That's all interesting.
Anything else, Tim?
No, that's it.
Thank you for your call, my friend.
All right, Tim.
Listeners, the toll-free is available for those of you who would like to use it. And Joe, if you're in Hartford, if you're still listening and would like to call us or email us, either one, we'd love to hear back from you after I read Doug's email. 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. The line is open if you want to give us a call. I'm to start the process. So this is going to be a baby step process of putting humans on the moon to stay. What is the bare minimum, and what is the function of this bare minimum hardware or structures? Again, this is for humans that you start out with on the surface of the moon.
Well, the bare minimum would be placing an existing structure on the surface. So if you imagine a structure like one of the space station modules, if you take one of those modules and land it on the moon at some particular site, and it's pressurized, it's covered with regolith, and then you send people, and maybe even send a rover, so they're not stuck at one site, and then you can send people there who could stay there for 6 months to a year, and explore and figure things out a bit about physiology, about psychology, about processing of the regolith, just to get started. I think that would be a reasonable first step that we have all the technology for, or pretty much all the technology for. It probably can be done relatively quickly if there was a real interest in that.
And what would the lunar knots, or I guess the astronauts, what would they be doing on this 6 month tour of duty on the moon for this first initial baby step settlement? What would their function be there? If we're going to sell this, what is the purpose of it? Why should we do this? I mean, you're selling this now to the American people and to Congress. So what's in it for Congress and the American people to put a half a dozen people or however many in this bare minimum structure on the moon to get them going for 6 months?
Well, you know, we've been talking about probably half a dozen to a dozen issues that we don't have the answer to. Such as how do you deal with a regolith? How do you process regolith in order to extract the elements to make something from that, from those elements? You know, what happens to the human body in 1/6 G over long periods of time? How difficult is it for astronauts to do small scale construction, you know, moving stuff around? You know, how easy is it to get around on the moon? So that there are issues that we're trying to resolve, both physiological, psychological, technical. And I think we have to prioritize those for, say, a six-month to a year mission to see what's feasible. And that would be based on what we would bring to the lunar surface. So, for example, we can test out some concepts that people have developed for processing the regolith for ISRU. We may be able to take small 3D layered printing presses to the moon and see if we can start building a second structure there over that period of a year using local materials and trying out various ideas. So I think all those, you know, we can pick and choose since there's so many different things we want to learn. The human stuff we would learn just by virtue of being there. When these astronauts come back, just like the one from the space station, we would, you know, see what happened to that person, because the space station is 1 year in microgravity and the moon is 1 year in 1/6 gravity. So I think from a physiological point of view, it'd be interesting to see what kind of decay, bone decay or circulation or other issues came up because of 1/6 G. That comparison would be an interesting thing to know. I think there are a bunch of things that we could do in a test mission like the one you described.
Okay, so to be the ultimate SOB antagonist for you on the show today.
Okay.
All of that stuff would be nice to know, but why should anyone in Congress, why should the American people give a bloody damn about any of it and want to spend money to go get answers for that material? Why?
Well,
what's the,
okay.
What's that? What, the guy that's working, you know, two jobs and, you know, they got a lot of debt and, you know, the typical American, you know, let's just keep it with America and forget the rest
okay.
of the world. For what's in it for them to go get those answers to those questions
okay.
that you've talked about?
So basically the larger vision is that we want to create civilizations on the moon and Mars for starters. And so how does that benefit the people on Earth that are paying, well, people in the United States who are paying for that? So one has to envision the creation of a whole new group of people who make things, sell things, buy things. It's an enlargement of the economy. If I had to pick one way to describe it, it's a huge enlargement of the economy over time. And anything that grows the economy is a good thing. And so in addition to that, we're growing the economy in an environment, the moon, that is very different from what we have on Earth. You have all kinds of new kinds of issues that we have to solve. We develop technologies to solve those. We know from Apollo that a lot of the technologies that we use to solve the Apollo problems of keeping people alive in space were transferred to the Earth. Medical technologies, materials technologies, computing technologies. So if you take that and now extend it to creating a city on the moon over the next 50 years, you can sort of multiply that by a large number as to all the stuff that we would develop and would benefit society. So it's just like, for example, you know, the government invests in research, and we invest in research, and that feeds back into the economy. So one could look at settling the moon as a research project, but eventually it has a life of its own. You know, it creates demand, it creates supply, it just becomes an enlargement of the economy. And that will help all kinds of people who want to have more high-tech jobs or their kids' jobs or their grandchildren. I think one of the big worries today in the U.S. is not only do people lose jobs that pay enough money, but they worry about their kids. You know, how are they going to get jobs? What is the next growth industry? You know? So in my view, the moon is the next growth industry, and it would basically more than pay back any money invested in it, as long as people understand the larger picture and that they may not immediately benefit from it, but their kids would certainly benefit from it, and I think that would sell to a lot of people.
You have another caller, and hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, it's Kim again.
Okay, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
I wanted to ask what you thought about teleoperating machinery from Earth on the moon, because it seems to me like there's a lot more that you could do if you hold off on sending people, because you don't have to send all the things people need, and you don't have to have the ship there to bring them back. How do you feel about just sending robotic equipment and using that to do the research and to do the construction?
I think that's a fine idea, and I think that most likely some of that would be done before we would send people. So these precursor missions would really test out the robotics, test out the 3D printing, do a lot of the stuff that you described, and would be important before you send people there. So I have no problem with that. I think that would be a logical progression before we would actually send people to live on the moon for extended stays. So we would need to make sure that how we design our robots and machinery and all that can actually operate, because we're talking about building a settlement on the moon or Mars eventually before the people even get there. So that would be a way to test the technology, and I think that's the way to go.
Because you were talking about the self-inflating structures, and I would really hope that if you have the robotic equipment there, you would figure out how to do construction without having to later send a ready-to-go module that has to do everything itself. Do you see any options for robots to build something that would be able to hold an atmosphere?
I think that would be the goal. The goal would be that you would send robots, and they would use as much local material as possible to build the structures.
I guess there's two ways to think about this. One is the way you're describing, where we develop all of the more advanced technologies so that we can build things in advance of people being there. The other option is, if we want to get there perhaps quicker, is to send the modules, the self-contained modules that we were discussing before, and just send them in advance or in parallel with people. And then the people would be there, and they could do some of the research on these autonomous concepts and the 3D printing concepts. So I guess there are different sort of strategic ways to get to the same end, and I think one would have to sort of compare the two and figure out the costs and the risks and the timelines before deciding one or the other. I can see an advantage to either one. One of them gets people to the moon quicker, and people are always more adaptable than any robot that we can build. The other way gets our development of the robots and puts them in the lunar environment and tests our concepts that way before we risk people. And so that also has positives to it. So either of those are reasonable, and one would have to sort of weigh one versus the other.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the robotic idea, because actually I think ultimately it would get people there faster, because you'd have so much more resources available for the savings you have on the things you need to do for humans. I believe really that robots would be capable of building something that could hold an atmosphere and be larger than any module you could send from Earth in fairly short order. And I have a particular attack on that. That's why I think that way. And it's in, you know, I'm still developing that. But I really think...
We're losing you again, Kim.
Okay.
We lost you there again.
Yeah. Okay. But in sum, I think robots first. I think it's faster for humans, too.
Okay, thanks, Kim. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The toll-free is available, 1-866-687-7223. So I have a note from John Hunt that I'll read on air. One thing to consider in favor of a moon base prior to a Mars mission would be to get experience for long-term habitation on another astronomical body. Given the time that one will have to spend on Mars, it would be good to get experience in a nearby location first, where short-term aborts are possible. And
I certainly agree with that.
Okay, and then you have another email from Tony Cook. What priority should lunar lavitude caves have in planning lunar settlement? Mars apparently has similar structures.
There are concepts that people have talked about once we discovered that they exist on the moon as well. And I think if one looks really long term, then eventually most of our settlements will be 90% or so underground because of the safety of that. And perhaps lava tubes might be a way to go. I'm not sure how large they are on the moon. They're probably not huge. The issue with lava tubes is that one would have to shore them up, make sure they don't collapse once we're doing stuff in them. But certainly one could use a lava tube to test ideas like that. You know, how do we shore them up? How do we build in them? Things like that. I think eventually, you know, there are images of concepts where one digs out something, for example, on the moon, and builds a structure and then covers up that structure almost completely. And one way or the other, I think we're going to have our structures mostly buried. Now, maybe one day in the future that we have very advanced materials and they can basically shield us from everything, but so far they don't seem to exist, and they may be far down the road. So I guess the short answer to your question is it's certainly part of a larger scheme of things that we should consider at some point, but probably not early.
Several weeks ago, maybe it's been closer to a couple of months ago, I was contacted by a graduate college student who had And I don't have permission to read or quote from the paper on air, but I have been in touch with the student. I'm trying to get the student to come on the show. But along with her professor who guided her, they see going to the moon as environmentally destructive and exploitation, not exploration, and it should not be done at all. End of story. And this person is from a very famous and very prestigious East Coast school. So you might even know the professor if I could look it up. But I don't have permission to use any of this on air, so I'm not
okay.
going to say it. But I will tell you it's not Rutgers. But it's in a nearby state. But then everything on the East Coast is a nearby state.
Right.
What have you to say to that?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to caring about the lunar terrain and the Martian terrain, and there have been numerous papers written about safeguarding sites and safeguarding certain geological areas. You know, certainly. Safeguarding all the landing sites of Apollo and the Russian sites as historic areas. And people have written that there should be opposition to, for example, strip mining the lunar surface, essentially erasing all the craters, right? So,
uh-huh.
So I'm sympathetic to that. And, just like on Earth, I believe that it's possible to do both. You know, I don't believe it's either or. I think it's possible to explore without destroying, and I think it's possible to mine without destroying, and some care has to be taken, and probably it's a good thing to talk about these things now before there are any economic interest in there, because once you have economic interest, then nobody pays much attention to anything else. So right now there's no economic interest on the moon, and therefore it's a good time to sort of think these through and create a framework where we can explore as well as develop as well as safeguard.
So you don't find this to be completely out in left field?
It's not left field, but to say that we shouldn't do anything, I think, is left field. I think there is a middle ground where we can safeguard as well as explore. Exploration does not necessarily mean destruction, in my view, if it's done right.
Harrison is giving us an email from Denver, and he says, I'm a little bit confused. What exactly today in 2016 is our TRL for humans on the moon with some sort of habitat to sustain their life and allow them to be productive? Can we do it? Are we not yet ready? What are the facts about our technology readiness level now in 2016?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not sure that we have the rocket technology, the constellation. I don't think it's there to take us to the moon. It doesn't mean that we're that far away. You know, probably maybe we're 5 years away from having that capability. There is NASA work on parts of the technology, on the capsule, and so that's one thing that we're missing. We don't have the structure that we want to place on the moon, if we're talking about placing like a pressurized cylinder for habitation. We don't have if we want to go the robotic way, we don't have robots that can build on the moon yet because it's too complicated and there's too many issues with the dust and other issues. So today there's nothing really in place, but all the things that we need are not that far off either. So I don't know how to attach a TRL, a single TRL, because there are many different technologies and they all have their own TRL. But I would say if somebody decided today that they really wanted to go to the moon and they're willing to put the money that's needed to do it, and reasonable money to do it, we could be there in 10 years, right? Because if you think about it, I know we're not going to spend Apollo-level money, but 50 years ago, almost 60 years ago, we were able to do it with almost no computer capabilities, with very weak abilities in manned rocketry. So today we have a lot more experience. We have much, much more advanced computers, materials. we know a lot more. But a lot of the stuff that we did then, we would have to recreate today. So that's the unfortunate thing. But I don't think we're that far off as far as, you know, human, compared to human lifespans. You know, I would say within 10 to 15 years, we could put people on the moon for long duration stays, given that somebody really wants to put the effort and guarantee the funding for those 10 to 15 years and not keep changing the designs, you know. So it has to be a serious plan, you know, that where we design something and then we go and do it. I think it's doable. It won't be very autonomous, probably, and it won't be a permanent facility where people will live forever, but it'll be what the original concept in the 60s was, that once we landed on the moon, we would put teams of 6 people to 12 people to stay there for 6 months at a time, and we would, and that's how we would basically create the eventual permanent settlement. So that's what I'm envisioning as the first step.
Sarah is in Seattle, and she says, Dr. Benaroya, to you, what would be the most interesting thing for astronauts to do on the moon?
That's a good question. I would think that the most interesting thing, and looking at it as a long-term, from a long-term point of view, I would think creating habitats is probably the most interesting thing, and figuring out all the technologies that we would need to develop to be able to do that rather rapidly. So that could be learning how to use the regolith to create building materials, how to do it autonomously, robotically, how to do 3D printing on the moon, all those things, I think. Basically creating the infrastructure, I think, is almost the most critical thing, because the reality is, if we're going to have people on the moon, they have to live comfortably, they have to be physically safe, psychologically comfortable, and how we do that, you know, the whole area of space architecture, creating an environment where people can live permanently, I think would be a first priority, and then from there we can really do whatever we want. And obviously part of that, it's not engineering, it's more physiology, making sure that they're physically safe but also physiologically survivable.
So creating infrastructure is what would get your juices running, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably more of a structural engineer than anything else, so I like structures. I think structures are interesting. It's conceiving of a city on the moon, I think, is a really exciting thing.
Oh, wow. Doug sent in a note, Dr. Doug from Southern California, with his most interesting thing. And you know what? I bet I could take 10 guesses from you and listeners, and not one of you would guess it. You want to try? you want to try and see what do you think he said the most interesting thing would be to do on the moon?
Is it science related?
I'm not going to give you a hint. Just say
okay. Just
what's the most interesting thing Dr. Doug said would to him would be on the moon.
How about space astronomy?
Oh, so far away, it's not even funny. And I don't know if anyone's going to send in another guess. It's too hard to do. So I'll just have to tell you. He says the most interesting thing to do on the moon would be to have children. But we're a long way from that.
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting thing. I can see that. See what happens, right?
That's right. And in some instances, you couldn't do any worse than you do here on Earth. So, you know, who knows? But he's right. We're a long way from that, and got a lot of steps to go, you know, before we get there. Yeah, well, that would imply you could really have a settlement. That would imply, you know, kids, family, education. You know, all of what happens in an outpost, in a village, a town, you know, and allows them to grow.
Right, right. And yeah, I would agree with that. But they need a building to live in.
Now, I don't know that if that implies you could bring the dog with you or the cat with you from Earth, you know, so the kid has a little animal to play with. But that may be down the road, too.
Yeah, Yeah, I guess the question is, how do you teach animals not to be very scared in a low-G environment?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that, but they probably, maybe they would enjoy it. I don't know, or maybe they would adapt. What do you think? I don't know.
Like humans, they would have to adapt. Take the benefits of low gravity with them.
Yeah, but I don't know if you can reason with them like a human. I just don't know. That's beyond my pay grade.
Yeah, me too.
But what should we have asked you about that we haven't asked you about, or we've forgotten or omitted or glossed over or dismissed? What else is there that you want to make a point on today, since we're coming up on a two-hour show?
First I would say you had a great audience today with a lot of great participation and great questions. So I really enjoyed the show. It was great to talk to all your callers and emailers. So that was a lot of fun. I would say that I would just emphasize something that we touched upon earlier when we were talking about how to promote space. And I would say that one can't underestimate how important and how broad the impact of a space program would be on young people. It's just something that is inherently a very positive view, you know, the view of expanding into space and having settlements of humans on the moon and Mars and other places eventually. That is, in my mind, that's almost a purely positive vision of the future. And one thing we don't have today, given everything that's happening around the world and in this country and everywhere, it's not so positive, that the next generations will have to find something positive to work hard toward. And there are other fields, obviously, you know, sub-disciplines and things like that are exciting and motivational. But space, I think, is so broad as a positive force that I think it could have a huge impact on future generations and current generations that are now in elementary school and entering high school, and kids are trying to figure out what to do with their lives. And I think because space is so vast and basically embodies all of human activity, no matter what you want to study, it impacts space, a successful space program. So I would say that, you know, if you really believe in it, then try to convince, you know, the next generation that it's important, and teach them about it and talk to them about it. And I think that's also one way to sell it to the population at large and the politicians. You know, why should they put money into it? Because it's so vast and it's such a positive influence on the next generation, and it can have huge positive impact on society in so many ways. So I think that's sort of a good way to cap the show.
So let me ask you, because we talked about this earlier, about government missions, private missions, and then the combo of public-private. So if you're wanting to have this huge positive impact and vision on the future and on younger people, students, probably middle school and up, maybe even younger, does it matter if it's a program that is a government program, that it's got government involved in it, or is it just as influential and powerful if it's 100% private sector?
I think it can be just as impactful if it's purely private sector. I think, though, if we're talking about seeing the evolution of space and humans in space in reasonable real time on a human time scale, then I think you're going to need both public and private. And you know, you and I and two other people wrote an article on this issue a number of years ago, public-private partnerships. I really think space at the current stage is really a public-private partnership kind of venture. And I think, look, we've talked about, it's 50 years since any major space activity with people outside of the shuttle and the space station. People on the moon was 50 years ago. And that time scale, it's hard to keep enthusiastic. I mean, people like you and I and others may be enthusiastic because it's what we do. But if you're talking about the population at large, you need to see real-time achievements. And so
I don't think that industry is at a point where it can actually do that yet. I mean, it's doing real-time achievements, but they're relatively small when we're talking about a space civilization. If we have governments and industry and a serious long-term effort, then we start seeing things in, you know, in two-year and five-year chunks, things happen. And that's a little bit easier to keep people motivated with.
Is that your closing comment as well, or do you have something additional you want to give us as a takeaway, or as a?
I think that's my main takeaway. I'm a major proponent for many reasons, and I think that there's a lot of exciting stuff happening. And I would say, if any of your readers are interested in
listeners.
I was thinking of a paper. If any of your listeners are interested in any of these things that are related to my research, they're welcome to send me an email, and I'd be glad to send them copies of papers that I've written on various topics in this area so they can read some of the nuts and bolts of it.
Do you want to give out an email address, or you want them to send it through me?
Sure. Benaroya, Benaroya, at Rutgers.edu. And if you forget that, you can just look up the Rutgers Mechanical Engineering Department, and you'll find my name there and my email address.
Okay, until the next time, my friend.
Yeah, it's been fun. I really enjoyed this.
And thank you. And listeners, that is it with Dr. Benaroya today. So do contact him and do read his book. And I should maybe make that. What do you think about making that public-private partnership paper available? Eligar spearheaded it, and you and I
right.
and Tom Matula did it. I'm actually referencing it when I'm doing this public-private partnership gig thing for the University of Chicago space event on April 9th, and I'm going to reference a little bit of stuff in it. It's still current, even though it's nearly a decade old.
I know. So I think it's timely, and I think I have no problem with you making it public to people.
You think Tom and Eligar would care? Probably not. Not this late day.
I don't think so.
Is it online someplace, or do I have to actually upload it to the blog? Have you ever seen it online?
I think sometimes if I do a search, I will find it sitting somewhere. So I think it's relatively out there.
Because if I can find it online, then I can just put the URL in the archive summary.
I think it's available online. You can just look up the title.
Yeah, I will check it out. And Eligar spearheaded this paper, listeners, and I joined in, and Chaim joined in, and Dr. Tom Matula, who is a marketing professor, space advocate as well, joined in. The four of us wrote this nearly a decade ago, right? Long before public-private partnerships were a household word, and it got published in a reviewed journal. Elsevier published it. So
that's right.
All right. If I can find it online, I will put the URL in the summary, and if not, I'll upload it to the blog.
Great.
Chaim, thank you, and until the next time, please join us now, listeners. As I said earlier in the show, Explore Mars is on tomorrow, but guess who's coming, not to dinner, but to the show on Tuesday night? Dr. Mike Griffin is back. So all of you who love Mike, you want to call the show. And all of you who absolutely hate him and think he ruined our space program with Constellation and the Big Rocket and SLS and his tour of duty as NASA administrator, you call the show too. The only rule is civility, civility, civility. And then Anatoly Zak has confirmed for Hotel Mars about the Russian role in ExoMars, which is now zooming its way to Mars, and some successful launches they're starting to have again with Proton. And that will be Wednesday, and I'm not sure when John will air it. He has gone to pre-recording these segments now rather than doing them real-time for the show. And then he has it pre-recorded on Wednesday, but he then decides whether he's going to play it Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and I never know when. So it makes it harder to listen it, but as soon as he plays it, I archive it on the Space Show website. So it's not lost, it just may be a day or two late. And then Friday morning is the final trilogy program, third program of John Strickland's Mars infrastructure organizational talks on the space show. This is the last one. And so there's no show also on Easter Sunday. So we all have a no space day on Easter, and spend it with your families, and have a good family experience. Everybody have a great week and a terrific rest of the weekend. Keep it safe, and come listen to us for Mars, for Dr. Mike Griffin. For those of you who heard his testimony in Congress a couple of weeks ago, this is why I have him back on the show. And by the way, Eileen Collins is coming back on the show. Not back. She is coming to the show for the first time April 15th, based on her testimony in Congress, an ominous day for Americans who work and pay taxes. But nevertheless, Eileen will be a bright spot on an otherwise gloomy, frustrating day of being held accountable for forking over our revenue to the government to do who knows what with, but not to go to Mars.
Right.
Or to go to the moon. So that's the week on the space show. And everybody, as I said, have a great week, and keep it safe. And please keep looking up. And special thanks to Dr. Ben Arroyo. Goodbye.
Thanks, David.
Goodbye, everyone.